Welcome to the Aronoff Report, where our host provides essential commentary and in-depth interviews with people in the know on politics, current events, and national security issues. The Executive Director of the Citizens Commission on National Security, Roger Aronoff, brings more than 50 years' experience as journalist, TV producer, documentary filmmaker, talk show host, and former editor of Accuracy in Media to his new twice-weekly show, The Aronoff Report. And now your host, Roger Aronoff.
Welcome to today's episode of The Aronoff Report. I'm Roger Aronoff, the Executive Director and Editor of the Citizens Commission on National Security. We're a nonprofit organization founded last year as a national security watchdog organization. While editor of Accuracy in Media, I had started the Citizens Commission on Benghazi, which you can read all about on our website, ccnationalsecurity.org. That's ccnationalsecurity.org. We came together to do our own investigation and publicize our findings about Benghazi. It was a group of retired admirals, generals, and other high-ranking former military people, CIA officers, and congressmen. And we all wanted to continue our work after Benghazi, which is why we formed this new organization. But we want to apply it to other national security topics. That's what we've been doing. So with this new organization, again, ccnationalsecurity.org. Our guest today is Saul Weisenberg. Saul is co-chair of Nelson Mullen's White Collar Defense and Government Investigations Practice. He has more than two decades of experience as lead counsel in complex federal white collar crime investigations and jury trials. Saul, I want to welcome you to the Aronoff Report, and I'll continue with your wonderful bio.
Thanks, Roger. Great to be here.
All right. Mr. Weisenberg's government career included serving as Deputy Independent Counsel, the number two position in the Whitewater Lewinsky investigation, and he was selected by Judge Kenneth Starr to conduct grand jury questioning of President Bill Clinton. Saul, as I enjoy pointing out, asked Bill Clinton the question that evoked the answer, "That depends on what the meaning of is." He is the author of White Collar Crime, Securities Fraud, from 2016, published by West Thomson Reuters. He's also appeared on the Today Show, NPR, ABC's World News Tonight, many other shows, and for the last year or so, he has been a Fox News analyst. And if you've been watching for the past week, he's been on Laura Ingraham's show four times in the past week. And one more thing, for transparency's sake, Saul and I have known each other for about 50 years. We grew up in Houston, and we are very close friends to this day. So again, Saul, welcome.
Happy to be here.
So what had you been doing in your professional career as an attorney that led to your being picked by Ken Starr to be one of his deputy independent counsels?
I was a white-collar crime prosecutor in San Antonio, Texas. Federal prosecutor, the Western District of Texas, specializing in savings and loan and bank fraud. A key element of the Whitewater investigation involved Madison Guarantee Savings and Loan and Madison Bank. And so they were looking for somebody with expertise in that area. And a couple of my friends worked for Ken Starr and suggested that I would be a good candidate.
Okay. Was there a particular case that had put you on the map?
I did the Victoria Savings Association prosecution, which is one of the biggest savings and loan losses in the country. It was identified by Congress as one of the top 100 losses, and I successfully prosecuted that case, and I guess that put me on the map. But really, it's a question of relationships, Roger. I was very close friends with Jackie Bennett, who was one of the deputies in the operation, and also Ray and Leroy Yon, the husband and wife team, who were involved in the Jim McDougal prosecution. And Ken Starr was looking for a go-to person on bank fraud, and Jackie recommended me.
Okay, so you arrived here 1997, and all of a sudden you were right in the middle of everything going on in the national media. What was that job like on a day-to-day basis when you got here and started out?
Oh, it was very exciting. First of all, the week after I came, Ken made the decision, which he later retracted, to go to Pepperdine and become dean, joint dean appointment for the Law and School of Public Affairs. That caused a firestorm, and he was criticized for leaving while still on the job, and he reversed himself. So it was very funny when he called the press conference to announce that he had changed his mind. Even though I'd only been in the office a week, I was only one of two people that had a suit and tie on. And so I accompanied him when he gave his press conference. I think the only other person there was John Bates, who's now a U.S. district judge. So here I've been gone for a week, and the folks back home saw me in the limelight. But generally, for a prosecutor, it was very exciting because there was a lot to work on. There were a lot of investigations still going on that really hadn't gotten a lot of press attention, and they were bank fraud related. So it was tremendously exciting and challenging and fun work.
And what was it like in terms of watching the media analyzing what your team was doing versus the reality you're doing?
Nobody's happy with media analysis, I think, most of the time. And the media was largely hostile to us. You have to remember, Fox News was in its infancy and did not at all have the kind of power that it has now. So the media was overwhelmingly skeptical of Judge Starr. Now, it got much worse after Lewinsky. But it was, I thought it was bad at this time, but we weren't really in the news every single day. When we were, the press usually got it wrong. It was frustrating, but not frustrating to the level it became when the Lewinsky story broke.
So I arrived here in Washington about the same time you did. I came here to work as a media analyst at Accuracy in Media, and I produced, directed, wrote several documentaries there. The first one I did was called The Clinton Legacy, which gave me also a up-close and personal seat. I was in the House the day they voted the impeachment. I was in the Senate when they were basically trying him after the impeachment. And so this documentary, The Clinton Legacy, in the opening I noted that the Clinton administration had been, quote, engulfed in a maze of scandals and lawsuits. The issues involve much more than sex and lies about sex. They involve evidence of illegal fundraising, invasions of privacy, obstruction of justice, and abuse of the powers of the presidency. I was talking about Whitewater, Filegate, Travelgate, Chinagate, hush money to Webb Hubble, using the FBI and IRS to go after their enemies. And my question is, you know, and I felt at the time, why weren't any of those or some of those more egregious, credible cases of sexual abuse, such as Juanita Broderick, used in the impeachment process? It seems to me it would have made for a more substantial case to remove him from office. This way, his supporters say that this was all about sex and lying about sex based on Ken Starr's sort of puritanical ethics?
Well, it's a good question. It raises a host of issues. You have to remember that some of those investigations you mentioned, we didn't have anything to do with. Chinagate, for example, we didn't have jurisdiction over that. Also, another kind of answer to your question is, even though under the statute that existed at the time, the independent counsel statute, we had authority to refer matters to the Congress, if assuming that they may be grounds for impeachment, assuming that we felt that, nothing stopped Congress from including these other things. So Congress could have included some of these other items. They could have put them all together and said this is just a corrupt presidency, but it did not work out that way. Chinagate, if you remember, was one that came along fairly late as an investigation.
Right.
But you had two different career prosecutors who strongly recommended to Janet Reno that she that she appoint an independent counsel, and she refused to do so. So, you know, I would say the Clintons got some lucky breaks there. On Webb Hubble, you know, even if you have something that's going on and you think it's suspicious, it doesn't necessarily amount to a crime. As you know, we found out that he received about $700,000 in consulting contracts when he was supposedly cooperating with us. But showing that he had consulting contracts and proving that he intentionally obstructed justice because he got money, that's a very difficult thing, particularly when it's filtered the way that that was done and the Clintons were protected. I mean, the Clintons weren't calling up Ronald Perlman and saying, hire Webb. It was done by other people who then casually informed the Clintons. So when you're on the outside, it's easy to say, why don't they indict? But in fact, you don't indict unless you think you can convict. And it's often a lot more difficult than you think.
Yeah, the line Webb Hubble used that got caught on tape was about after the, I think, was it $700,000 or $900,000, he said, so I guess I'll roll over one more time.
That right.
A great
right.
line. But so let's move on to the Trump impeachment. And
sure.
How do you explain what has happened so far? We know, for example, that Hillary Clinton and the Democratic National Committee paid approximately $12 million to the law firm of Perkins Coie, which hired Glenn Simpson's opposition research firm Fusion GPS, which in turn hired former British spy Christopher Steele. And that was an actual case to go manufacture dirt based on unverified reports from Russians tied to the Putin regime for the purpose of affecting the outcome of the U.S. presidential election in 2016. So if the issue they're talking about now to impeach Trump is that they claim he was digging up dirt on his political opponent from a foreign country, doesn't that apply to the Democrats and not Trump?
Well, I think that you've got with respect to Trump, the specific charge, the specific allegation is that he conditioned vital military aid to an ally that had already been appropriated, that he conditioned that on having the Ukrainians help him find dirt on his political opponent. Again, that's the allegation. I don't think the case has been made. I think even if you think the call was improper, it's nothing close to an impeachable offense. But I think it's very important to, I don't think it's necessarily two things that can be compared, because you would have to show, for example, I don't think there's an allegation that President Obama conditioned aid on, I've heard about him conditioning aid or the administration conditioning aid on firing a prosecutor, but I don't believe there's an allegation that he conditioned aid on getting dirt against a political opponent. But I think in a way to compare them lessens the severity and really the shocking nature of what was done in the 2016 campaign. That's really, I think, what is involved to a large extent in all the current efforts against Trump. I mean, sure, they hate Trump. Sure, they don't accept large segments of the left and the Democratic Party don't accept the results of the 2016 election. But I think a lot of what is going on is they're desperate to do anything to remove President Trump before Bill Barr and John Durham, the U.S. Attorney from Connecticut, get to the bottom of what happened. I mean, let's just step back for a minute. This is a presidential election, and the incumbent party is using the intelligence services to unquestionably spy on and get dirt on a presidential candidate of the opposition party. That is just a shocking and major event, and you better, as Barr said, as Barr said during his confirmation process, I believe, you certainly better have a very good reason to do that, and you better have very good facts. Like he said, hey, if it's a justified investigation, that's one thing. But it's It appears to be, we actually know that the affidavit that was given to the FISA court on four occasions contained serious omissions and, in my view, false statements. And that's very important. I can go into more detail if you want. And I think that's what they fear. I mean, I think that's as big as Watergate. That you want to talk about election interference, to basically use your intelligence services to gin up a case against a presidential candidate, even if you don't like that candidate, that's a big deal.
Well, no question about it. And the finding, the key finding in the Mueller report is this, that they, quote, did not find that the Trump campaign or anyone associated with it conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in these efforts, despite multiple efforts from Russian-affiliated individuals to assist the Trump campaign. And yes, you're exactly right as far as using the Steele dossier, going to the FISA court, and we know from the Strzok page text that they viewed it as this investigation as an insurance policy. They didn't really think Trump had much chance to win. But if he did, they would have an insurance policy, and that was this investigation that was based on these, the FISA warrants. I mean, the investigations that they had done based on the Steele dossier, which even when Comey, the FBI director, went to talk to Trump about it, he explained to him that they contained salacious and unverified charges that they were circulating.
And also keep in mind that Comey didn't tell Trump, we've been investigating certain people in your campaign for this collusion effort. He didn't tell him what was going on. He went to see him in early January, right. And all they told him was that, the Russians had colluded, were involved in an effort to not that the Russians had colluded with any Americans, but that the Russians had been involved in an effort to affect the election. And he told them about this salacious, unverified report. He did not tell Trump, by the way, we've really been investigating you. We've just said we're investigating somebody who was with your campaign, but really we've been investigating you. He didn't tell him that. And keep in mind, I want to talk about something because I hear and I see whenever I look at the left-wing media. First of all, they generally simply do not talk about this topic at all, the topic of the interference in the 2016 election by the intelligence agencies and by Jim Comey and the whole Steele dossier. If they talk about it at all, they roll their eyes. But there's no question. We'll know more when the Horowitz report comes out, and we'll know more when and if a Durham report comes out or Durham indicts people. But we know, for example, it's not just a question of omission, right? It's not just a question of not telling the judges. This guy, Carter Page, we haven't told you that he actually cooperated with the FBI in a previous investigation where the Russians tried to use him as a spy. And the FBI concluded that he wasn't one. They never got told that. So that's a material omission. But they lied as well because they say in there in a footnote that I don't remember the exact words, but they speculate that the person behind the Steele dossier, I think they call it Individual One, and they're talking about Glenn Simpson of Fusion GPS, they speculate that he may have a bias against the candidate, against Donald Trump. There was no speculation. They absolutely knew by the time that the first FISA application went in, they knew that Simpson was being paid by the DNC and Hillary Clinton. So then to say, we think, I mean, it's safe to assume, no, you knew. And that was a big deal that the court should have been advised of. So it's a very serious matter. I can't believe that it won't be a big part of what Horowitz does and talks about.
Well, the other thing that with Glenn Simpson, one of his clients was Natalia Veliskina, whatever her name is,
the
Russian woman who set up the June 2016 Trump Tower meeting where they kind of got Donald Jr. to come with the notion of that we have some dirt on Hillary. You know, are you interested? And, you know, said sure. And they got there, and that wasn't what she was talking about. But we find out later she had met with Simpson the day before and the day after, and this whole thing certainly appears to be have been a setup along this way.
I thought she had met with Simpson the same day. I thought she had literally gone from a court proceeding where she was there with Simpson to the meeting, but. Yeah, I think that's certainly very, very relevant. I think he said they were working together on another case. But, and it certainly does look like a setup. There's some people who think it was, some people who think it wasn't. I mean, when you send an email that says, you know, the Russian Crown Prosecutor, this is part of his effort to help Donald Trump, it sure looks like a setup to me.
Right.
But if you just focus on the stuff we absolutely know, for example, we now know that Steele went to a State Department official and made his accusations directly to her. And one of them, as part of his accusation, was that the Russians were working through the Russian consulate in Miami. And she points out in her report of that that there is no Russian consulate in Miami. And she says this guy is desperate to see Clinton get elected. She sends that to the DOJ before the first FISA application. Why isn't that in the FISA application? We know from Bruce Orr's testimony. That's really key testimony. I know there are a lot of people who don't like Bruce Orr and don't like what he was doing, but he appears to have been quite brutally honest in his testimony. And he says, I told the DOJ people from the beginning that Steele was biased, that he hated Trump and wanted Mrs. Clinton to win. That's not in the application that was sent to the FISA court. So those are serious material omissions, and they're lies. Okay, and people should pay a price for that.
Well, and it said in the FISA applications that all of this stuff from the Steele dossier was verified. And apparently none of it was, if any at all. And so who all signed the FISA applications? We know Comey.
Well, they're different people who sign. I mean, at first the FBI people sign, then ultimately the acting or deputy AG will sign, but their verification is different, I believe. They're just saying all the procedures here were followed. And I'm not, as we sit here right now, I don't remember all the details, but it's initially Comey, then it's Sally Yates, Rod Rosenstein does one. But to me, the key is the affiant, the person who says, I swear that the following is true. That's the person, and anyone who knows that it wasn't true and lets it go through, those are the people, as an initial matter, who have to pay the price for what they did if they did something that was wrong. You talk about, I want to also keep in mind, what is verification here? Andy McCarthy has done a great job of pointing this out. They spend a lot of time talking about how reliable Christopher Steele is. But he's not the informant. All right. When you're talking about an affidavit, any kind of classic affidavit for a search warrant or a FISA warrant, when you talk about verification, you're talking about verification of the credibility of the informant. All right. Steele was not the informant. Steele was basically no different than a private FBI agent. You would never have an affiant say, for example, I am a reliable person. Well, we assume you are. You're an FBI agent and you're signing the thing. But they go out of their way to say that Steele, their first source, is reliable. But none of his stuff was direct. All of his stuff was double hearsay. You've got to go beyond that. You've got to verify, have some kind of verification of the people that he's relying on, that Steele is relying on. That wasn't there at all. And so one of the things that's very interesting is the court, how the FISA court just rubber stamped this. And I think there should be some embarrassment there.
Well, were they deceived or were they part of this plot in any way? I mean, for them to go along with it, do you think that they should have smelled a rat here?
I think the important thing is that they were deceived. They really relied upon and have a right to rely upon, FISA is serious business, the truth-telling of the person who makes the affidavit. And I think if they had known what had been left off and what was false, they would have taken a much closer look at it. They certainly should have taken a very close look, given the subject matter. And my understanding is they rejected the initial application.
Well, and as you're talking about Steele not being the actual source of this information, you can't help but think about what we're talking about today, this so-called whistleblower, who also wasn't the source. You know, he or she got this information, this CIA officer who signed that whistleblower report, what they call the whistleblower report. It was the same thing. But let's finish up on Mueller, and then we'll come back to this again. But the other part of the Mueller report was about obstruction of justice. And for weeks, when they saw that what he said about no coordination or conspiracy with the Russians, then it was they were going to ready to impeach him over obstruction of justice. Mueller listed 10 examples, such things as, McGahn being told to fire Mueller or telling Sessions to unrecuse himself, things that never ended up happening. But yet they were talking about that as being, and some number of prosecutors all signed a letter, said, oh, this is a crime that he committed and all that. But
if he wasn't president, he would be indicted, I think was what they were saying. Anybody else would be indicted for that.
Right. Yeah. So what did you make of that whole thing,
Well, I made a number of things. First of all, to say that if he wasn't president, he would have been indicted. You know, if grandma had balls, she'd be grandpa. The fact is, he is the president. And that factors into the legal analysis, because the idea, there's a rule, there's Supreme Court law on this. There are Office of Legal Counsel opinions, but there are also Supreme Court cases, more than one, that say if an application of a statute, if you're trying to apply a statute in a way that would interfere with the president's Article II powers, you don't apply it that way, right? Unless there's a clear statement by Congress that they mean to, that they mean for the statute to apply to the president. So when you say, for example, that the firing of Comey could constitute obstruction of justice, when the president of the United States has the unquestioned authority to fire Comey, it's an absolutely lawful act. To me, that's utterly absurd. Now, as it turns out, and a lot of people don't know this, when Mueller talked about the events surrounding the firing of Comey, if I said Mueller earlier, I misspoke. We're talking about the firing of Comey. If it turns out that even Mueller says, you know what, there's a real question of what the motivation was here. It looks like he was mad at Comey because Comey had told him he's not under investigation, but Comey refused to reveal that publicly. So even Mueller doesn't say that Comey was fired because Trump was afraid of the investigation. And as you point out, a really important point that Bill Barr relied on in saying that this is not a crime, is that the investigation was allowed to go forward and that there was complete cooperation. I mean, the cooperation given by the president's first set of lawyers, Ty Cobb and John Dowd, was remarkable. They waived a number of privileges. So that's an important thing to keep in mind, that number one, there's no way. Just the idea, think about this for a minute, you're talking about a thought crime. The idea that if you do something lawful, if you have a bad motive, you can be indicted, to me is preposterous. And yet, that I can't tell you how many legal experts went on camera to say that. And by the way, I think it's preposterous whether you're the president or not. They found an article by the Brookings Institution, which is what kind of the hive was following, found five or six cases in all of American legal history where there was dicta that said, you know, you can't, a lawful act can be, an act that's on its face is lawful, can constitute obstruction if you have a corrupt motive. There are a handful of such cases, but they all involve very different fact patterns than what you had in something like the firing of Comey. Right. Right now, I'm just talking about the parts of the obstruction allegation that have to do with things within the president's power, like firing Comey. So I think there's no support for it. I think if it had ever gotten, if a case like that ever gets to the Supreme Court, they haven't directly ruled on it, they would laugh it out of court. It would be overturned 9-0. And in fact, in the Arthur Anderson case, which was a 9-0 opinion, if you look at the language closely, this wasn't the direct reason they overturned the conviction, but they make it pretty clear that for there to be witness tampering, which you had in that case, allegedly, that you got to be doing something that's inherently wrong or inherently unlawful. So sorry for the nerdy law stuff, but that part of the Mueller obstruction section I thought was ridiculous, just absurd. In fact, the only obstructive act, allegedly obstructive act, that I thought could arguably be criminal obstruction of justice was when he, and even that's not clear, is when he asked Don McGahn, right? Remember, he had asked Don McGahn to take care of firing Comey. And then when he found out that McGahn had said that to investigators, he asked McGahn to make a statement, or I think President Trump read in the New York Times that McGahn had said Trump ordered him to fire Mueller. And Trump wanted him to issue a statement, McGahn, for our records, quote, denying it. And McGahn refused to do so. That is something that comes close to obstruction. For example, if he had said to Don McGahn, I want you to write a letter denying this story, denying that I told you to fire Mueller, and I want you to send it to the Mueller people, that would be, assuming you could show that the president knew he was not telling the truth, that's obstruction of justice. But what Trump said was, put it on a sheet of paper for our records. Now, that's still a serious thing if you know an investigation is going on, because if McGahn was ever called on to testify, that statement could be used to impeach him. So that was a very foolish thing the president did. There were a lot of things detailed in the obstruction report that President Trump allegedly did, and I think it's pretty clear he did do, that were very, very foolish. He was repeatedly told, don't try to do anything to Mueller, let him continue his investigation, and he just didn't listen to people, right? Even Corey Lewandowski had the sense to ignore President Trump's request, oh, go call up Jeff Sessions and tell him to make an announcement that Mueller isn't going to be able to do his investigation anymore. Well, you know, he had the sense not to follow it. So
he says he went on had this station instead, is what Lewandowski says. But yeah, so it raises the question, if Trump is saying these things and they don't do them, and he doesn't supersede them and do it himself, then you think, well, maybe he's just blowing off steam and he's just saying, do this, and they, you know, they kind of just ignore him and walk away, and it doesn't happen, and he still has the power to do it. I mean, if he really wanted to do it, but so bring some.
Well,
of those.
I think it's a good point. The bottom line is, I don't think there's enough in the obstruction section,
right,
to support impeachment. But it's troubling behavior, and to me, the most troubling part of it is that. Both with respect to the idea of speaking to Comey, right? He wanted to speak to Comey about the Michael Flynn matter, and he was told by McGahn, don't do it, but he didn't listen. And then he was repeatedly told, to lay off on Mueller, and he can't. It almost looks, if you read the report, he can't control himself. To me, not the alleged criminal activity, but the inability to basically do what everyone is advising you to do, telling you this is dangerous for your own self-interest to do, and he insists on doing it. I find that troubling, but again, I don't find that impeachable. It's like, look, he might not be my perfect candidate for president. I didn't vote for him. You may think he's a terrible president. I know you don't, but a person may think he's a terrible president, but guess what? He won the friggin' election. Okay, live with it. Live with it. I mean, he won it, and guess what, folks? He won it fair and square with an assist, an unintentional assist from Jim Comey, of course.
So let's talk a little about Barr. First, finishing up on the Mueller stuff, Barr's March 24th letter summarizing the key findings, and he was just blasted for that. They said he completely misrepresented what was in the report, even though the report was coming out. You know, it was being vetted for classified material and such. And so that sort of started this this idea that Barr is just, you know, he had written this audition letter to get the job, and now he was there, and he was just acting as Trump's attorney and not as the nation's attorney. And that theme has came up then, and it's come up again now, you know, over
well,
this.
A couple of things.
Yeah, please.
First of all, it's a pretty good audition letter. It's too bad nobody in the department was thinking about it already, because it's a brilliant letter. I don't think it was an audition. I think it was saying, hey, somebody wake up here. Somebody wake up and look at this, you know, he was saying what I was saying at the time. This whole idea, that doing something that's within your executive authority is illegal or impeachable or is obstruction of justice is laughable. Okay. So I think he was a guy just looking at this saying, my God, who is, you know, he wrote this letter after a report came out in the paper, and I was shocked too that Mueller is asking all these questions about that show that he's really seriously looking at obstruction. And he's asking for information about what you were thinking when you tried to fire me and all this kind of stuff. So I think there's nothing wrong, you know, with the letter. The whole idea, Barr did not misrepresent anything in his letter. He was surprised that he thought Mueller would have already given him a redacted report that he could publicize, a report that took out all the confidential stuff and the grand jury stuff. Barr was surprised when that wasn't done. Now, Mueller prepared summaries, right? If you look at the Mueller report, and that Barr had it, and none of the other of us had it, it did have summaries. And I think the people on Mueller's staff were very angry that Barr didn't release the summaries. But guess what? In my opinion, that's a very political document, the Mueller report, particularly the obstruction section. And a very tendentious document, particularly the legal discussion. So Barr was under no obligation to publish those summaries. What he did, there's nothing incorrect about Barr's summary. They're just unhappy that he didn't phrase it the way that Mueller did, and he didn't put in all the dirt, you know, that the Mueller people thought they had. But as you point out, it was all out in a matter of weeks. So what's the problem? You're mad because you don't like the way it was spun? Well, too bad. You should have done your job, and you should have had a redacted version ready, and you didn't. So, you know, those are, I guess, my points. Two points here. One, nothing was incorrect in Barr's summary. Nothing. And two, he wasn't obligated to publicly release the portions of the report prematurely that Mueller's folks wanted released. And I want to make it clear, we're talking about Mueller's folks, because after seeing Mueller testify, it's not at all clear to me that he was running the show in any significant way.
So you referred to Andy McCarthy earlier, and he has a new column out today, and I would tell everybody that's the essential reading you need to do. Like, he puts out three or four columns a week to explain everything going on, and it's essential reading, really. Today he writes, Democrats and their media friends are attempting to bleach away that context and paint the Barr investigation in the public mind as a corrupt extension of a down and dirty Trump 2020 political campaign. Republicans are not going to respond effectively unless they grasp this strategy, end quote. And I think he has a very good point. If they can paint the Barr investigation of the origins of the Russian hoax as a corrupt political act by Trump and Barr, then if Durham decides to indict Comey or McCabe or Brennan or anyone involved in that whole effort, they and their media allies will say it was all revenge on Trump's part rather than being justified. What do you think?
Oh, yes, that's exactly what's going on. I've been saying that for days. This is really all about discrediting the Barr-Durham report. That's what it's all about. They're deathly afraid of that. They are hysterically afraid of that. That's exactly what's going on. That's why the call was unfortunate. The president isn't always aware of these subtleties of what you are and aren't supposed to do at a governmental level. And I agree with you. There is not evidence on that call of extortion. And I've just recently found out, I think you told me this, that now it turns out that the Ukrainians didn't even know the money had been held up, correct?
That's right. That was reported in the New York Times a few days ago. That's right.
Yeah. How long did they know before it was
released? It was another month before they found out that it was being withheld. And of course,
after the call, right?
Yeah, after the call. So obviously it wasn't being used as leverage during the call, you know, to
either that
to...
or they were too dumb to realize it. But so again, I guess my point is they are going to do it. Andy's right. The Republicans need to be very much aware of that. They'll do anything they can to dirty up Durham. There's absolutely nothing wrong. And they really can't dirty up Durham. So they're dirtying up Barr. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the Attorney General of the United States or the President asking a foreign country to cooperate with one of our investigations, right? There's nothing wrong with that. Now, Barr and Durham aren't investigating Biden for anything. So that's why they try to lump it in. You're right. They want to try to lump it into the Biden thing. But they are investigating the 2016 election, and it's very appropriate that it's being investigated, and they have every right to ask for help.
So, just one or two more things here.
Yeah.
When Pelosi jumped before the microphone with about, I don't know, 19, 30 flags in front, right behind her, she wrapped herself in. My question was, you know that tomorrow is going to be the release of the transcript or the memo of the conversation, as well as the so-called whistleblowers report and something from DOJ on their evaluation of this. Why not wait another day before you talk about opening an impeachment inquiry? And my take was that this is because she really knew or felt that there wasn't going to be anything too damaging in there, but I know there's such a demand from my base, from the Democratic base, to start this impeachment thing rolling, that we just have to do it. And we know the media, they've been chomping at the bit on this. They'll go along with this. So whatever's in what Trump releases and the administration releases tomorrow, that won't stop us or slow our train down at all. And
well, I certainly believe that they wanted to shape the perception of what happened. That's clearly what's involved here. Because remember, they were relying on they were waiting for the Mueller report like it was going to be manna from heaven. They were waiting and waiting and waiting, and look what happened. It gets delayed. The release gets delayed a couple of weeks because Mueller's people didn't have a redacted version. Okay, then they think Barr spun it, and you know, that it didn't happen right. So it's as simple as this. We're going to get out a day ahead, and we're going to say this is what it says. And so I think it's as simple as that.
So I've seen articles that say that by not taking a vote in the House, to proceed with an impeachment inquiry, and maybe there's some confusion what they're voting on to start an inquiry, voting on impeachment, that the Republicans are not allowed to start subpoenaing witnesses, and that is the strategy that Pelosi is employing. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I've heard that too. I'm not an expert on congressional procedure, so I don't know if it's accurate or not. But
all right.
Certainly people who I trust have said that's accurate. But here's, and that's very unfair. That's not how it was done in Watergate. But keep in mind, at the end of the day, they're going to have to vote. If they want to impeach the guy, they're going to have to vote. And I think if the public perceives that it's a rigged process, I think that that's going to be a real problem for them.
So, the big question that I get is, when is something going to happen from Durham or somebody? Because I think if all of these people walk away from this, we're talking Strzok and Page, and we're talking McCabe and Comey and Brennan and Clapper and all the way if nobody gets indicted for any of this that we've been talking about that happened to the Trump campaign and the Trump presidency, this effort to undermine it, it's going to look like, well, look, the Trump administration with their people investigated it and couldn't find anybody to indict for anything. And people, we've been waiting for this Horowitz Inspector General report, Durham. Does he even have a grand jury impaneled? I mean, this is something that a lot of people bring up to me. They're very concerned about. How can you enlighten us on that one?
Well, you can't. I mean, I know people want heads to roll, but the fact is, it's never as easy to indict someone as people think it is from reading the paper. And it's you've got to prove an actual crime beyond a reasonable doubt. And we shouldn't be indicting people, even if they've done something wrong, unless they've committed a crime. So you got to let the process take its course, particularly with respect to Durham, who's only really been looking at it now since Barr delegated him. Now, Horowitz, who can't indict anybody, his report has already been sent to Barr. It's going to be released in redacted form, apparently in a few weeks, and we'll have a chance to look at who he recommends if anyone be indicted, and so we'll certainly know some stuff then. We know that Horowitz has recommended that McCabe has been indicted. That report was declassified a long time ago, and we know that they said he lied on four different occasions. I can't remember, two or three of them were under oath. And I looked at that and thought, this is very, very serious. And as hard as it is to prove false statements and perjury cases, particularly in Washington, D.C., it struck me that this was a righteous case to go forward on. Obviously, his attorney has come in and made a pitch of why they shouldn't do it. And his attorney is doing a brilliant job of trying to influence the future D.C. jury pool by talking about it in the paper and suggesting that one grand jury declined to indict, which he wouldn't know about anyway. So I would just say, be patient. You don't want to indict somebody who isn't guilty. You don't want to indict somebody who deserves indictment too soon and have them acquitted. So, stay the course. I mean, I think Horowitz is a straight shooter. And Durham is a straight shooter, from everything I've heard, with real, prosecutorial experience.
All right, final question. So as somebody who lived through the last impeachment in this country, Bill Clinton in the late 1990s, any predictions on your part of how this process will roll out, will turn out, and do you think it could help Trump in next year's election with the kind of blowback by people resenting that this whole thing took place?
Well, based upon what I've seen so far on what's today, the third
of October.
And I don't see it as getting us to an impeachable offense. First of all, we know that the Senate isn't going to convict him, barring some stark new revelations, right? So it's obviously not going to go anywhere, but unless there are big bombshells, and unless there are big bombshells that the Republicans in the Senate are seen as ignoring. I don't see it helping the Democrats at all. I see it as being potentially disastrous for them. And I think there are a lot of people just saying, look, there's a country to run, and you had your shot with Mueller, and this is much ado about nothing. But I do think the president doesn't help himself with statements that imply that, you know, he wants to unmask the whistleblower. They do more than imply. I don't think it's wise for him to say about the people who leaked to the whistleblower, they're like spies, and you know what we do with spies. Those are inappropriate comments, and actually, he doesn't seem to realize you can talk yourself into an impeachment by making inappropriate comments. So I hope somebody's advising him of that and that he listens to it.
Well, you might not have seen this, but just before we started this interview, Trump had a press conference, and he was accusing Schiff of perhaps being guilty of treason for his so-called parody as when he started out his hearing last week.
Yeah. But that's not smart either, to suggest that even somebody as unpopular as Schiff among the Republicans should be arrested for treason. But, you know, I've seen people accusing Trump of treason for the last 2 years. And treason has a very, very technical term under the Constitution. And Trump isn't guilty of treason, and neither is Schiff. So it doesn't do any good, I think. But particularly it doesn't do you any good to be talking about what we do to, you know, it's one thing if you talk about a congressman. It's another thing if you talk about a guy who, even if you doubt whether he's a real whistleblower, can make an argument. He's certainly a potential witness. There are statutes against witness intimidation. He needs to really be careful. You can talk yourself into an impeachable offense. Impeachment doesn't just cover crimes. Now the whole thing, he's also saying it's a coup. I'm going to tell you, every president who's been seriously investigated says it's a coup. Nixon said this was a coup. Hillary Clinton said Whitewater was a coup attempt. And now Trump is saying it, and I get it. But I'm just, I think it goes on the current state of the record, to get back to your question, it goes nowhere, and it can actually hurt the Democrats.
Right, and as you point out, it's not necessarily, doesn't necessarily require a crime, because if they have the 218 votes, they can talk about abuse of power, obstruction of justice, just in general, because, you know, they hate this guy, they think he's not fit to be president, they think he was, you know, corruptly elected, all these sort of things. But we'll have to leave it there, Saul. I want to thank you so much for coming on the Aronoff Report today. Our guest again has been Saul Weisenberg, former deputy independent counsel, today one of the great white-collar criminal lawyers in the country. And he's right now a Fox News analyst, has been for the last year or so. You can see him a lot there. And we'll continue to be watching this along with you, Saul. Maybe we'll have you back on later in a few months.
That would be great, Roger. Thanks so much. It was great being your guest.
Thank you. So long. So we're going to wrap it up there, folks. This has been another episode of the Aronoff Report. There's so much going on with this, and we'll continue to cover it, the various aspects of it. I want you to come visit our website, ccnationalsecurity.org. That's for Citizens Commission, ccnationalsecurity.org. And take a look around. We've got a lot of great articles. Got all the other podcasts from this, the Aronoff Report, lots of interviews from our other great members, Tom McInerney, Paul Vallely, articles by Alan West, Steve Emerson, a lot of great stuff. And come on our website, take a look, support us. We really can use it. And till the next episode of the Aronoff Report, signing off. So long.